It's now time to hit the rewind button as we join those cheeky chaps over at the Retro Asylum.
And welcome to episode 227. Crikey, how time flies. Of the Retro Asylum. It's Chris. All on my own. And that usually only means one thing. It's interview time. And again, that's right. It is interview time. There is a cracking interview coming up with Francisco Gonzalez, otherwise known as Grundislav Games. Francisco is the designer, creator, writer, artist, pretty much everything, mainly, of some of my favourite point-and-click games from recent years, and probably my favourite freeware game ever in the Ben Jordan series. It was so, so nice to talk to Francisco, who gladly gave up his time in the middle of what was a work day for him with the time difference. And we chatted about his inspirations, his career, his future plans. And maybe we got a hint of a sneak peek about what might come after his forthcoming game, Rosewater. But yes, yeah, stay tuned for that. Other than that, there isn't really a lot to say. So I'm going to get straight into the interview with Francisco. Here it is. Oh, before I do, one thing I almost forgot to say. You may have heard a new and revised theme tune on the way in. Yes, that's right. Steve, who composed and arranged the first version of the Retro Asylum theme tune, has worked his amazing magic again and has come up with a version two. He is very, very, very talented, that boy. And he has done an amazing piece of work. So a huge shout out to the wonderful and multi-talented Steve Erickson. Thanks for all you do, mate. Now, anyway, on with the interview. Here he is, Francisco Gonzalez, talking to me, Chris Worthington. So I'm here with Francisco Gonzalez. Francisco, welcome to the Retro Asylum. How are you?
Thank you. I am well. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Thank you very much. And I gotta just say a massive thank you for taking the time out, because it's 8 p.m. or just after 8 p.m. in the UK, but this is right in the middle of one of your work days. So I really appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us.
Well, I very much, as I said before we recorded, appreciate your interest in talking to me.
Yeah.
And I mean, it is in the middle of the workday, but it's kind of winding down. And also today's been one of those like creative rut days, so I very much appreciate being able to actually like talking and just talking about games and stuff.
Yeah,
kind of reinvigorates me, so
you
appreciate
might find some inspiration.
Yeah, I might just
can I just ask, do you still have your noisy heater?
I do still have my noisy heater, but it is currently about, I have to do the conversion, it's hot outside, so the heater will not be turning on. The heater as of late March has not been on, and I don't anticipate it will be back until September. So now is the prime time to be doing streams and things.
The listeners are wondering why, when I'm talking to one of the more prominent point-and-click developers of the day, I'm asking about your heater. For anyone who doesn't know, hasn't heard Francisco speak before, go back and look at some of Francisco's other interviews and you'll hear what I mean about his heater. It's a good thing.
You'll know what time of year the things were recorded if you hear my heater. Also, yeah, it's 26 degrees outside, so there's no heat.
Keep that heater off. We have a thing here on Retro Asylum Francisco. When we start episodes, the question that we ask initially is, what have you been up to? Now, I'm just going to put a spin on that and say, Francisco, who are you and what have you been up to for your whole career? Give us a 2-minute bio.
Wow, my whole career.
Give us a quick bio before we dive into the detail.
When you say whole career, do you mean like my whole game design career or just my whole career from the beginning?
Let's stick to game design.
Okay.
Who are you? What do you do?
Well, my name is Francisco Gonzalez. I am an indie developer based in Brooklyn, New York. I specialize in point-and-click adventure games, by which I mean that's all I make. I use a program called Adventure Game Studio that I've been using for roughly the past 19 years. I started off making freeware games as a hobby, and as of 2013, I decided to finally take a crack at doing it for a profession. And so I released a game called A Golden Wake. And since then, I've been very lucky to be able to continue doing this for a living and for my full-time job. So I've been making games since then. I've made a game called Shardlight afterwards, Lamplight City after that, and I'm currently working on Rosewater. And that is basically, in a nutshell, who I am and what I do.
Perfect. Yeah, great. Exactly what we were looking for. So I want to take you back to the early days, because we are a retro gaming podcast and you make modern games. There's no doubt about that. But there's a definite, there's obviously a definite aesthetic and style to your games. So take us back to the start. What was the point at which you as a young gamer thought, you know what? I could have a go at this. I can do better than those guys.
I don't think I ever thought that, but my early experiences with adventure games were the old shareware Hugo trilogy, if you remember those.
Oh, wow, yeah. Wow, yeah, I do.
I still credit those games to this day with my ability to type fast, specifically like the room in the first one with the mummy, and you had to or you had to throw the pork chop at the dog and you had to type really fast in order to not get killed. Yeah. So I always liked, I grew up and I played, let me start that again. I played the Hugo games as a child and I really enjoyed those. And I also played King's Quest V, but on the NES. And that's a terrible port. But somehow they managed to put the whole game on an NES cart, which is impressive.
Amazing.
Yeah, and it doesn't have voice acting, which is a plus for that game. As a young, impressionable youth, something about the whole adventure genre and just being able to play a story and like solve puzzles and do stuff like that. I really enjoyed that. And I always wanted to design my own. And I played around with like a bunch of engines like Click and Play and this shareware program that was called like Adventure Maker or something that was terrible. And so I always had this sort of desire to make my own adventure game. But it wasn't until I found Adventure Game Studio in 2001 that I actually sat down and created something. Never looked back afterwards once I finished a game. I think that was the most important thing I ever did, was actually start a game and finish it, even though it was like super short and terrible. But the fact that I was like, yeah, I can do this and I know what's involved and there we go, I can do it. And
Is that something that's typical then of others that are starting out, that they tend to kind of just leap from project to project and never finish anything?
Well, one of the things that I used to notice a lot in the AGS community, because the AGS, the great thing about Adventure Game Studio is that it still has an active forum and a pretty nurturing community. And, you know, there was never, it was one of the few internet forums that didn't have a bunch of jerks on it. Even to the point where there's still a yearly AGS meetup.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. But one of the things I noticed was that, and, you know, it's a completely understandable phenomenon, is that once people realize that they can do or they can make an adventure game or any kind of game, really, they think that the sky is the limit. And that's not necessarily a bad attitude to have, because obviously you want to be as creative as possible. But at the same time, I feel like it's really easy to overscope and start a project that you think is going to be like the next Monkey Island or the next King's Quest or whatever. And like you write this amazingly detailed design document and you realize that, especially if you're doing it on your own, that it would take you years to do this. And especially if you're doing it as a hobby and you only have a certain amount of time to work on it, then it's really easy to just be overwhelmed by the whole thing. And
yeah, for sure.
If you don't really have any motivation to do it, because I mean, as trite and cliche a phrase as it is, game development is not all fun and games. Like, there is work involved, and there are some days that are lots of fun and lots of and very creative and everything, but there are some days that are not. And you know, if it becomes a chore, if it becomes work, and then it's very easy to just say, I don't feel like doing this. And then if you keep doing that, then your interest dies, and that's why it's really easy to just lose focus on a project or just quit altogether.
And
that's I saw that a lot, unfortunately. So that's why it was always important to, for me personally, to just have an idea of what I could do realistically and you know, not stretch myself too thin.
Yeah, for sure. So how old were you then in those days when you started to actually complete projects, when you actually started to create your very first kind of rudimentary games? Were you 18? Were you 15? I mean, was it a case that you were in school and you were dreaming up these projects and then going home and rushing to the computer and working on them?
Pretty much, yeah. I was in college. I was 19, and one of my fondest memories is the series of games that I sort of started seriously doing, the Ben Jordan games. I made the first three of those in a year, in the span of a year. And I remember I designed and made the third one over the summer when I was at summer school at university. And I would go to class in the morning. I think I was only taking like two classes. I think on, let's say, like, if it was Tuesday and Thursday mornings, I would go in the mornings. You know, I'd go to class and then I'd come home, and I lived in an apartment that was like basically across the street from campus. So I'd come home in like the middle of the day in the summer in Florida, where it was nice and warm and raining. And I would just like sit in my room and put on some music and just like start making the game. And I don't know, it was just something that was so nice about that I still fondly look back at. I'm probably looking at it with like super nostalgia rose-colored glasses. It was probably miserable. But I was like, oh, that's so nice. And it's funny because like the third Ben Jordan game seems to be most people's favorite. And so I'm like, well, maybe some of that and that like happiness that I felt while coding it rubbed off on the actual game or something. I don't know. But yeah.
Yeah. Let's just take a step back and talk about Ben Jordan.
So sure.
When did you first, because for those who don't know, and I hope that people, if they don't know, will go and find out. Anybody who's listened to me talk on our Discord channel will know that I'm constantly pointing people to the Grundislav Games website, because that's one thing that we haven't said, is that your trading name, if you like, is Grundislav Games.
Yes.
And that is you. And you have a website, and anybody who types into Google Grundislav Games, they're not going to get anywhere else, are they? They're only going to get to your site with that distinctive name.
Yes. And I want to point out that if you go to my website and you get a redirect to like, you've won a prize, please reload, because I've been having some real trouble with malware on my PHP files lately, and it's huge pain in the ass, and my site has not been hacked. It's just really annoying, and it goes away if you reload it and it's not destroying your computer. So
okay, yeah. Cool. thanks for pointing out. I've not noticed it, but yeah, that is useful intel.
So
Grundislav Games is Francisco, and on your website there is your freeware series Ben Jordan, which I know that you did other projects kind of in and around the same time, but in my eyes and as in my experience, that I see that as your first thing, if you like, that was brought.
Is that right, that's right, because I mean I did a few, like you said, I did a few things in between, but nothing of the scale and scope of a Ben Jordan game in between. I basically from 2004 to 2012, it was that was what I was primarily focused on.
So where did the inspiration for a paranormal investigator, which is what Ben Jordan is, I've always wondered whether it's an autobiographical thing.
it's not really autobiographical, because I don't really believe in the paranormal.
Okay.
A lot of people think it is because of my lack of art skills for the first three games, I took pictures of myself and put them on the title screen and sort of like photoshopped the hair red. Really the only autobiographical element is the fact that Ben Jordan dresses as I did in the mid 2000s with like a white t-shirt and green cargo pants.
Pretty much the same as everyone the way they dressed at that time.
Yeah, but the inspiration was kind of a mix of two things. Mainly, I mean, the whole paranormal investigator thing was because I'm a huge fan of Gabriel Knight, Sins of the Fathers, if that's not obvious by pretty much every game I've ever made. And also around that time, because I had worked on a few games in the Reality on the Norm series, which was like a community-based sort of series. Where anybody could make a game and the art assets were shared and stuff. I'd sort of, you know, gotten my footing making games with that. And then I decided I wanted to do my own thing. So I had like what I said before about overscoping. I had come up with this great design for this big game about like, you're this guy who was traveling around the world, because it was very stupidly meta too. The idea was that, oh no, Chris Jones, the creator of AGS, had lost the source code of AGS. So you had to go around to all of the different countries where like the prominent members of the AGS community lived.
Yeah.
And you would find, you know, you'd go on like this worldwide hunt to find the source code. And it was silly, and it didn't really go anywhere, and it was way too meta to be of interest to anyone who wasn't an AGS community member. Sure. But the whole idea of like the world travel thing stuck with me. So I was like, well, let's see, maybe I can make a series about going around the world doing something else. And then I thought, well, I mean, I like Gabriel Knight, and he's a paranormal. He investigates paranormal stuff, and he goes to different places. So I was like, well, what about if I do a game about a paranormal investigator who's just a regular kid, like fresh out of college? But instead of doing like monster of the week type things, what if he goes to different places, and then I can showcase like, you know, different cultures and different like folklore and specific legends related to that particular place in the world? So that's pretty much where it came from. And I started off doing a game about the Florida skunk ape because I was in Florida and I had grown up in South Florida and I knew about the skunk ape. So I was like, well, you know, let's start with this. And then I just started Googling and looking for interesting stories in different places. And that's kind of where I just put together the whole series, because I figured I could make the games short enough that I would make each game a separate case. And then try and have like an overarching story thing.
Did you always know it was going to be 8 episodes long, or was it just a case of let's just see where we take it?
It was like that for the first two games. And then when I started on the third one, I decided to sit down and do like an overall series document. And then at that point, I think I was between 8 and 10. But then as I wrote more, I was like, I can do this in 8. So that's when I decided on 8, which technically it ended up being 10 because I did remakes of the first two. So
You're very self-deprecating about the visual style of the first couple. Even though they are basic compared to what you've done later, but you probably won't blow your own trumpet here. But you do everything apart from the music. You write the thing. You do the graphics. I watched an hour of a stream, I think it was last week, when you were animating a pedestrian for your new game, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you literally do everything. I mean, what was that like in those early days? Did you feel like you were playing around, or did it feel like you were creating this thing that people, I mean, when was that? It was 2004 released episode one. Yeah. Here we are 16 years later. And I'm telling you about how much 19. I enjoyed even eating that.
Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. No, you're right. 2004, it is 16 years today. I can't do math, and yet I program.
That's good to know that you can't do something.
Yeah.
16 years later, here we are, and I'm telling you that I still, even the very basic game, I still find that interesting to look at, and it's a joy to play. How does that feel when you go back to those early games now and think, do you cringe or are you proud?
It's hard. It's sort of a mixed feeling. I mean, obviously, it's incredibly... I appreciate the fact that people have played the games and people like you who say that they still enjoy them. And, you know, the fact that people have played the games and gotten some enjoyment out of them, that means the world to me. I mean, yeah, I felt like I was just... I was just playing around when I started. Yeah, I thought, okay, well, I want to make a game. I'll put it out there. If somebody plays it, great. And yeah, I was actually pretty surprised at how, you know, well received the Ben Jordan games were, especially looking like they did. And yeah, I am self-deprecating because
they're not that bad. They're really not.
I do cringe when I look at them though, because it's like, what were you thinking? I mean, I cringe. Honestly, I've been doing the art for all my games with the exception of Shardlight. And Lamplight City, Lamplight City is the first game that I did the art for where I thought, this is acceptable. Everything else I've just been like, whatever. Like, I can get away with it. Whereas Lamplight City is the first time I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I mean, I'm okay to look at this. Because, I mean, I don't want to go off on a tangent, no pun intended, about my art history or anything. But, like, just the fact that I didn't really learn to do proper perspective until Lamplight City is painfully obvious in a lot of stuff. And then there was the whole thing with Ben Jordan 8 where I somehow decided that it would be a good idea to draw the backgrounds in pencil and then scan them in and paint them on the computer. And I don't know what I was thinking doing that, because it doubled the work and it looks not great. And yeah, I don't know. But I forgot what the original question was. I'm sorry.
Well, it was about what it's like to go back and look at those early games. And I think you've answered that.
Yeah.
And I absolutely think you do yourself a disservice, particularly with those later Ben Jordan games. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I said to you just before we started recording that I haven't played the Ben Jordan games, and I wanted to play them before we spoke. So over the last 2 weeks, I've played all eight of them pretty much back to back. So I've in a very short space of time, I've seen that transition from the early kind of episodes 1 and 2 right through to 8. And that's a long time. I mean, that span was 8 years, I think, between the releases. And that the difference when you put one, the very basic version of 1, next to 8 is phenomenal.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely phenomenal. The music is just something I wanted to touch on before we move on.
Yeah.
I think the music in the whole series is fantastic, and I know that's the one thing that you didn't do.
That's why it's so good.
No, not at all. The name of the composer for the early games was a guy called Andreas
Slott. Yeah,
yeah. How did somebody who was making a freeware game? Was he part of the community, or did you reach out to some composers? How did that all come together?
So he was, he was a member of the AGS community. He was on the AGS IRC channel, as we all were back then. He volunteered to do the music, and he was really, really great. I haven't talked to him in years. I don't know what's become of him. I actually feel kind of bad because, like, the first case only had, like, maybe 5 tunes. And he, you know, with each game, he did progressively more and more music. And I think his magnum opus is Case 3, because I still adore the work that he did on the soundtrack of Case 3. Case 4 is good too, but, like, the music in Case 4 is a little bit more sparse and more, like, horror-y. But I love what he did in Case 3. And I understand, like, it got to the point where I was making these games and I was asking him to do all this for free, where I feel like I kind of burned him out. So when we got to Case 5, I was like, listen, I could tell that, like, he wasn't as enthusiastic. And I was like, you know, I appreciate everything you've done. This is great stuff. Like, I'm not going to keep asking you to do this. Like, if you want to hand it off to someone else, I'll totally understand. And he was like, yeah. Oh my God, I appreciate that so much. Like, I didn't want to. So, like, there's some pieces in Case 5 that he wrote, like the title theme and a few others I forget. I'd have to look at I think he wrote quite a few for 5 before he stopped. But then a friend of mine put me in touch with a guy that he knew that was also a composer, and he stepped in and kind of finished up what was missing. And then for Case 6, there was another guy in the AGS community that did a few tracks, but he was busy with other stuff. So I was like, well, I'm not going to make you do a bunch of stuff. So then I got in touch with Peter Gresser, who had done the music for a couple of AGS. Actually, I don't think he had done any AGS games. He had done the Blackwell Legacy. And so I got in touch with him, and he did the music for Cases 6, 7, and 8. Mm-hmm. And he also did an amazing job. And I worked with him on A Golden Wake. He was the composer for that.
Yeah.
So that was cool because I was like, finally, I get to pay you for your work.
Do you see music as a big part of games generally, but in particular kind of those narrative atmospheric adventure games?
Absolutely. I mean, I was the nerdy kid who, you know, growing up, people were listening to like pop music and I was listening to film scores and like music that I had recorded from Sega Genesis games or Sega Mega Drive games off of the, like using a tape recorder. Like I've always loved game music. Some of my favorite soundtracks are still like the old classic adventure game stuff. Like when The Secret of Monkey Island, when Monkey Island 2 Special Edition came out, the thing I was most excited about was hearing the soundtrack played with live instruments, because I knew every single note of that score. I had listened to it so much. And like, even watching a behind the scenes video, I'm just so nerdy. I was watching a behind
the scenes. You go for it. You're in good company.
I was watching a behind the scenes video of like the making of right before it was released. And there was a section about the music, and there was a section where they were like, they showed a guy recording and he was playing like a muted trumpet. And I was like, I know exactly what track that is. That's the bit where Guybrush goes to the party on Booty Island. And I was like, oh my God, this is going to sound so cool. The instruments sound exactly like they should. And then actually, funny side note, I met the guy, Will Roger, who, was one of the guys in charge of that remaster and the music.
Yeah.
And he told me how much time they had given them to do it and what they had paid them. And I was like, that's a criminal offense, but you guys did a great job. And then they told me that the only thing that they had to work with was like a file that had all the iMuse cues on it. And like, they had to basically transcribe the entire score from scratch. And I was like, how did you do this? But I'm glad you did, because it's amazing. But to go back to your question, I think music is very important in games and especially in narrative games. Although I will say that, and this, we could probably talk about this if we talk about voice acting.
You prompted my next one.
one thing that I find interesting, especially now that I make games with voice acting, is that, a lot of the older games that didn't have the pre-voice acting games, I think the music had to carry a lot more of the weight because it was what you were listening to. Whereas now, like with voice acting, the music doesn't necessarily have to take a back seat, but to have like blaring looping music all the time sometimes works against the voice acting. So I've been a little bit more aware of that and a little bit more conscious of like when I speak to my composers and I tell them like what we need for areas or scenes or whatever.
I feel like we could probably do a whole conversation about the music in the games, and I don't want to do that because I want to move on. But I've got one final question on the music. Mm-hmm. I did notice a sniff of iMuse in A Golden Wake, where there was a few times when there was a theme that did adapt. Do you, when you're kind of thinking about what the composition and what the score will sound like, how much direction do you give to the composer, or do you just describe the game to the composer and let the composer go off and work his or her magic?
I generally give the composer as much creative freedom as I can. But I do like to have the composer play the game so they get a feel for it. And a lot of the times they ask me for you know, to play the game. I think that's the best way to so that they know what they're writing for. I mean, it depends on the composer, but so far all the ones that I've worked with have wanted to play the game. And yeah, like there's a few times where I've done a few iMusey things. Like, I did it in A Golden Wake and I did it in Lamplight City a couple of times.
Yeah.
It's nothing like as complex as, say, something like Woodtick in Monkey Island 2, or like depending on what part of the track is playing, there'll be like a special little transition thing that then goes into the next piece. But it's usually just like a little crossfade into the same track with like a different instrumentation or whatever. But yeah, I mean, generally speaking, you know, the composer will ask me, like, what's the mood of the scene, or what is the area like, or describe what kind of thing is happening here. Like, for Lamplight City, we had a whole spreadsheet where it was like, okay, well, this is this, and like, this is this part of the city, so maybe it should sound like this, or that sort of thing.
So voice acting then, which you touched upon a moment ago. So for the last two Ben Jordan episodes and the deluxe versions of episodes 1 and 2, you introduced voice acting. What was it like when you heard your characters talk for the first time? Was it strange?
It's great. I still love hearing my characters talk for the first time. That's like the joy of doing voice acting is like you've written these characters for every game and you finally hear them brought to life, and it's so cool. I love it.
And how did you cast them? Because I know in the commercial games I've seen in the credits that you have people called casting directors, which sounds very, very official and very grown up. But in those early days, I recognize, you know, I think Dave Gilbert pops up in a couple of them. Chris Jones plays Quincy Jones, doesn't he? Jordan. Chris Jones, who designed the Adventure Game Studio. And you yourself make several, not just in your own games, but you've starred in other games too. In fact, your Moby Games credits is long.
Oh God. I haven't looked in a while.
You ought to have a look. How did that work? Did you just go out to the community and say, guys, does anybody want to come and star in my game?
Yeah, pretty much. That's really pretty much exactly how I did it in the beginning. Once I started working with Pete Gresser, he knew a guy who, Devin Mack. He knew a guy named Devin Mack who was, he was basically like a casting director for, I mean, he was also a voice actor, but he was, he also did casting for like anime fan dubs and things like that.
Right. Okay.
So through him, he put me in touch with a few other people. And so that's how I got a few people for some of the games. In other cases it was either that or just like friends I knew who did voice acting or wanted to do voice acting. I mean, the quality of the voice acting is pretty inconsistent in the Ben Jordan games, but I mean, I didn't have any like professional voice. Actually, the one exception was this amazing guy, Philip Sacramento, who played Cardinal Genovese in the last two Ben Jordan games. That guy knocked it out of the park, and still to this day I'm like, how did I get this guy? But he approached me and he was like, hey, I'll do this for free, and I was like, okay, thanks.
Approached you where? What, just sent you an email and said, can I please star in your game?
It's so weird that people did that. I like every time I would reach out, like when I reached out to I think it was when I reached out to Pete Gresser and I was like, hey, listen, you know, I know like you were recommended to me, like I do this little series of games. And he emailed me back and he was like, my partner was like, you would be so stupid not to do a Ben Jordan game, do it. And I was like, what? So yeah, word travels around, I guess, which is always a nice surprise.
Yeah, it really is fascinating. And, you know, you say about the qualities inconsistent, and yes, I suppose it is inconsistent. But look, I'm playing Resident Evil 6 at the moment, which is a 2012 game. And I kid you not, the voice acting in the Ben Jordan series is considerably better than that game that had an infinite budget and was produced by one of the largest development companies in the world.
Yeah, so sometimes...
It holds up.
Well, thanks.
It does. It does hold up. So, Ben Jordan, it feels like a done thing.
Yeah.
Is he a done thing, or will we ever see... Other than the short film that you did, which is out there, it's there.
Wow, you
it's
really on have YouTube. You really did do a deep dive, didn't you?
it's a wonderful thing. So,
oh boy,
will we ever see Ben Jordan again?
I don't really think so. I feel like the series had a pretty definitive end, and honestly, and I'm not being self-deprecating here, like. I told the story I wanted to tell, and really, Ben Jordan, a guy who goes around solving or investigating paranormal things, it's not the most unique idea or property. Like, I'd much rather do more unique and interesting things and find new things to do. So, you know, I did that. I got that out of my... Well, I got some of it out of my system. Now I've really gotten it out of my system with Lamplight City. but, yeah, no, I think Ben Jordan has run his course.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I'm eternally grateful to everyone who played the series and who enjoyed it and who still asks if I'll do any more of them. But, yeah.
Now, people are still playing it, you know. I am...
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I only played it for the first time about 3 weeks ago. So there you go. You know, 2020, there are people playing it for the first time. So you please continue to make it available, because I'm sure there'll be more that want to discover it.
I will keep making it available as much as possible, but unfortunately, I no longer have the source code because of various hard drive. I know, I still have all the assets, but I don't have the source code anymore, so I'd have to rebuild the games from scratch. And
oh, crumbs.
Yeah. Yeah,
yikes! That sounds scary. Mm. So at some point, then you realized, I don't know what you did as a day job, but at some point you realized, maybe I could actually do this for a living. What? How did that come about, and how did that kind of eureka moment feel?
So I was working as an interpreter. I was a legal interpreter. For civil cases, which basically meant I got to go to depositions and listen to people talk about their insurance claims or their medical malpractice suits and all sorts. Yeah, I did that for 4 years, and it took its toll mentally because it was a very antagonistic environment, and it was just ugh. So in 2013, I decided that I wanted to move to New York. So I quit my job. I had already sort of, I already knew that that Dave Gilbert of Wadget Eye was interested in publishing a game of mine. And at that point, I had already come up with the idea of a Golden Wake. And I had already started designing it. And so I had already been wanting to move to New York. So in 2013, I quit my interpreting job. I moved to New York in August of that year. But before that, I decided, since I finally had some free time and I had some money saved up, that I wanted to go to Australia, because I had wanted to go to Australia for years. Okay. So I went to Australia, had a great little vacation there for 3 weeks. And when I was coming back on the very, very long flight, I did sort of have an epiphany moment, because my original plan was that I was going to go to New York and I was going to try and get freelance work as doing interpreting stuff and sort of work on the game again in my free time.
Yeah.
But coming back, I was like, you know what? I've saved up enough money. And every time I go on vacation, anytime I would go on vacation, I'd come back, I would think, ugh, I have to go back to work. Mm-hmm. I want to do something where when I go on vacation, I come back and I'm like, I'm excited to get back to work. And I think game development is going to do that for me. So I thought, okay, well, I have enough money. I can live comfortably for a year. And that should be enough time to finish this game. So yeah, that's when I decided I'm just going to do this full time. And I dedicated myself to doing that full time. And A Golden Wake came out, and it didn't do great, but it did well enough that I was able to make the next game, Shard Light. And I was on a salary for that, so that was good. And then, yeah, I've just been lucky enough that I've been able to continue doing it. And each game has done progressively better than the last. Yeah. And so, yeah, just I've been able to sustain myself doing this.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, it's good to hear. Mm. A Golden Wake, for those who don't know, is a work of historical... What do you call it? Is it historical fiction?
Yeah.
Or is it actually a... Yeah, I suppose it is, I suppose, because Alfie Banks is not... Alfie Banks is the main character in A Golden Wake, and he's not, if I'm not mistaken, he's not a real...
Yeah, the main character is fictional, but the backdrop and most of the characters you meet are real. So
yeah. So were you you had this then in design before you decided that you were going to make it a commercial game? Was it a case of you talking to the community about what you were thinking and Dave Gilbert saying, "Please, please, please, come on, Francisco, I want to publish it, please, please, please"?
Well, no, actually. He had told me that he was interested in publishing a game of mine in like 2007, but I was still working on the Ben Jordan games, and I was like, "Well, I don't want to go commercial before I've finished what I started," and so I finished the Ben Jordan games. I had had an idea previously for another game that never went anywhere. It was going to be a story told from three different perspectives, like the same event happening. I think it was like someone was murdered and you played each game. It was a triptych of games and each game starred a different character, but it was all revolving around the same event and like little bits of the story were seen from different perspectives. And like, it was like a socialite was one of the characters, a male prostitute was another, and an artist, I think, was the third one. And that never ended up going anywhere, except I made a game for TIGSource. The TIGSource website had a game jam type thing, which it was the adult/edutainment competition where you could make an adult-themed game or an edutainment game or a mix of both. And so I made a game for that. Yeah, I made a game for that called Backdoor Man, which was about the male prostitute. So it was a fun little romp, a night in the pants of a male prostitute, as one review put it.
Wowzers.
Yeah, and that's actually tied into A Golden Wake, because it's an unofficial sequel to a game that I hadn't made yet. So yeah,
there we go.
But yeah, by the time I decided I was going commercial, I came up with A Golden Wake, and the intent was always to be commercial with that game. It wasn't that I had started working on it and then decided, oh, this will make a good thing. It was just, oh, this is an idea for that commercial game that I can do. So
now, obviously, the process must be so much different when you're doing this commercially than when you were doing the Ben Jordan games. How much with A Golden Wake, and I suppose this question can also apply to Shardlight and Lamplight City, how much pressure does the publisher put on to have the game out by a certain date, or are you given freedom on that?
I've always been given freedom with that. That's basically, I mean, obviously this depends greatly on the publisher. But like in the case of A Golden Wake, I pretty much had free rein to just design the game as I saw fit. I think Dave played it like maybe 3 or 4 times before it was done. But it wasn't like, you know, you have to have this out by a certain time. So it was basically just that. With Shardlight, I was my own boss on when it should be out, because I was like, we've been working on this for so long. Oh my God, I have to get it out. I feel bad. I have to get it out. Looking back on it in hindsight, that game probably would have benefited from a couple more months of sitting down and like designing it a little bit tighter.
Interesting. Yeah.
There's a few bits at the end that feel a bit rushed. Yeah. And I think that's partly because I was like, oh my God, I have to get this finished so we can get this game out.
and that was your self-imposed pressure.
Yeah, yeah,
it wasn't coming from anybody else.
No, it wasn't. In fact, I remember an email that I sent to Dave where I was like, I think we can have this out by November. And he was like, really? Because you would still need to do this and this and this and this. And I was like, oh, I guess you're right. I guess we can't have it out by November.
Shame. You have to finish it.
Yeah. Save, and like with Lamplight City... again, like, I didn't have any pressure to have it out. It was my own pressure where I was like, I need to get this game out so that it sells and I can make money, because I don't have any income right now.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, I think people forget, don't they, that all the while, I suppose you get that initial kind of surge of sales, and then I imagine it kind of slowly kind of falls off. And you need to make some money during that time to sustain you.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Golden Wake and when that was released and in the lead up to release. You'd obviously done many projects, but not projects which were released commercially before then.
Yeah.
Did you feel a different kind of pressure knowing that people were going to be paying for the game?
Oh, yeah.
And they're going to probably be judging it in a different way?
Absolutely. I had this this sort of mental stigma in my mind between commercial and freeware quality. And I was like, well, people won't pay for this. This has to look this way or else people won't buy it. Or this has to be this way or else people won't buy it. But no, definitely. I understood that it's a big ask to get people to buy your game, especially nowadays. It wasn't even that big a deal in 2014. But yeah, it was definitely a difference between the people who just were like, oh, cool, free game to download, and oh, I have to pay for this. So yeah, I mean, I tried to up my game and you know, do as best I could. And I mean, I look back at A Golden Wake, I'm like, I could make this look so much better. But it was the best I could do with what I knew how to do at the time. And, you know, I can say that about all my games. You know, even looking at Lamplight City now, I'm like, ooh, this is so blocky. It's weird. It's so weird how when you're working on something and you're like, yeah, this looks cool. Like, I think one of the last times I went back and I looked at Ben Jordan 8, I was freaked out at how choppy the walk cycles looked because I was only doing 8-frame walk cycles then. And now I do 10-frame walk cycles. Yeah. And I'm like, my God, how did I ever think this looked good?
Yeah,
it's weird.
I must say, it's one that is definitely one thing I did notice. Having gone from Lamplight City to Ben Jordan, I think I was playing. It was episode 5. Is the one where he's in Japan, isn't it?
Yeah.
The wonderfully titled "The Land of the Rising Dead," I think, which is absolutely brilliant.
I did not come up with that title. I got someone from the AGS community to come up with it, and it's my favorite one. And I'm like, it's great because I didn't come up with it, and it's fantastic. So I can say that.
But the difference there in the way that, as you said, the animation on the characters walking, it kind of fits the game. But when you look at the difference that in just that one little thing to what you did later in Lamplight City, you can see the difference.
Yeah.
And just going, so again, this probably applies to all of the commercial games. I don't know whether you've seen, there was Sony released a kind of a making of the God of War game on YouTube probably about 12 months ago now. And it's an interesting documentary. One of the things that really struck me was that moment when the reviews dropped. And I think the head of the project was hunched over his laptop.
Oh, yeah.
And was waiting for the reviews. And he just started crying, you know, when he's seen the reviews come in.
Yeah.
What was that moment like? Because were you waiting on desperately for the reviews to come in? And was it really a nerve-wracking time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The release day is terrifying. It still is. It still is.
So it doesn't get any better.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And I've had that moment of hunching over and crying, but not because the reviews are good. No, I'm kidding. I haven't actually cried because of bad reviews.
Well, you've not had... The games haven't been reviewed badly, have they?
They haven't been reviewed... I mean, there's been a couple of instances where the games have gotten, like, maybe one terrible review. But overall, they've been okay. Like, A Golden Wake was sort of... mediocrely reviewed, which I get it. It's a niche game about a real estate agent. Like, you know, I get it. I think one review that still I remember to this day said that it was like watching an elementary school production of Scarface or something like that.
Oh, damn.
And I was like, wow, that's very specific. but yeah, like, Shardlight was better received. There was one review, because obviously you only remember the bad reviews. There was one website that gave it a terrible, terrible review that destroyed the Metacritic score, which was a shame, but who cares? But yeah, with Lamplight City, I remember, like, it was midnight And I was like, oh my God, oh God, here we go. I hope people like this. And like the first game, the first review was a website, which I won't name, but a fairly prominent game review site. And I think they gave it like a 6 out of 10 or something like that. And I was like, no. Oh no. But then, you know, the reviews that did come in were generally a lot more positive than that. So I was like, well, that's good. But yeah. But I have not, I have yet to make a game that's like universally acclaimed, which, you know, it's not something I mean, obviously I want people to enjoy the games, but it's not something that I'm like, I have to make an amazing game that everyone will love, because I don't know. I feel like if you make a game that either everyone loves or everyone hates, you did something wrong.
Possibly.
I mean, it's nice to have a game that everybody loves, but I don't know.
Do you take it personally when you do read those words? I mean, that elementary version of Scarface just seems like it's plain rude. But if you do see a bad review, I mean, is it hard not to take it personally?
Yeah, it's a little hard not to take it personally. But, I mean, I understand. Like, a lot of the times, I've never read a review. Well, that's not true. I've maybe read one or two reviews where they point out something that I'm like, did you play the right game? Because I don't remember that. But generally, like, the less than stellar reviews make fair points, and, you know, they highlight things that are, you know, they're true. But yeah, it's very hard not to take the stuff like that personally. Actually, the person who, the same reviewer that made that comment about Scarface also reviewed Lamplight City very poorly. And I'm like, I guess this person just doesn't like my games, which is fine. I mean, you can't please everybody, but it's like, why do we still give this person review codes if they're obviously not going to like? I don't know. Anyway,
I think sometimes I think it still feels like, and you may disagree, but it still feels to me like it's a reasonably niche genre, the adventure game.
Oh, I don't disagree at all. It totally is.
Yeah, and it feels like there are people who will just never get adventure games, probably never have, never will, never don't understand what the appeal is, and will probably have a negative opinion on the vast majority of adventure games. And then you get people, probably like me, probably like you, who just enjoy the genre, who will see something different in those kinds of games. I've heard you talk about A Golden Wake before, and I do want to move on, so I won't dwell. And I know that you've just said it yourself, you know, you kind of make a lot about it's a game about a real estate agent and how interesting can that be. You know, I still find that there's a lot to like about the game, and I think things strike different chords to different people. You know, one of the things I really enjoyed about it is, at the end, you know, when you kind of merge the pixel art characters into the photographs of the real people, that's so cool. I kind of want to now go back and play it again, knowing that they look so much like. I think the thing that for me that I struggled with was the action, kind of quasi action sequences.
Oh yeah, yeah, that airplane puzzle was not well coded. I have gone back and fixed it. It just hasn't been updated because I don't have access to that. But I mean, the thing with the Golden Wake is, and yeah, I don't want to dwell on it either, but like, I don't think it's a bad game. I'm still proud of it. It's a little rough around the edges, sure, and I didn't set out to make a boring game, but the elevator pitch is, yeah, it's a game about a real estate agent, and it's not just a game about a real estate agent, obviously. No, but you have to play it to find that out. And I think, just like, you know, the initial sell of like, yeah, it's a game about a real estate agent in the 20s, like, some people will be like, oh, that's different, that sounds cool, I'll try it. But a lot of people are like, ugh, that's boring. No. So yeah,
well, I liked it.
Well, I'm glad you did.
The definitive last word. I think it's good.
Thank you.
Moving on then. Yes. So we that was your one and only work of historical fiction, because then we move on to your two most recent games. And the first of those was Shardlight. Now, Shardlight was a collaboration with a graphic artist called Ben Chandler.
Yes.
How did that come about? And having worked on your own, having done all of your own art and graphics in the past, how was it kind of handing over control of that to somebody else?
So Shardlight, basically, after I did A Golden Wake, I had this idea bouncing around in my head where I wanted to do another historical game about the Black Plague. I had two ideas. I wanted to make a game about the Black Plague, and I wanted to have a character that was a personification of death that was represented by a giant raven.
Right.
So I talked to Ben about it, because Ben and I had gotten to know each other just through the AGS community, and like just we became friends and we're talking. And when I went to Australia, like I hung out with him the whole time I was there. We went around and did a road trip and stuff. So yeah, we had talked about Shardlight, or well, what became Shardlight, because I was like, we should make a game together. And we like expanded on the idea and turned it from, you know, medieval game about the Black Plague to post-apocalyptic future about plague. We were oddly prescient about that.
Very timely.
I know, it was it's horrifying. But so anyway, so we had this idea to make this game. And then in sort of the interim, he started working for Wajedi full time. And so we just said to Dave, look, we have this idea for a game. Like, would you be interested in us doing this? And he was like, yeah, sure. So that's how that came about. And then, as far as like him doing the art, it was a relief because I got to, I got to focus more on the design and the writing, and the programming. And yeah, it was cool to like, I would do these very rough sketches and these very rough placeholder sprites, and then he would make them into characters and backgrounds, and I was like, oh, this is cool.
And what was it like? I mean, when he said, oh, what do you think of this? You know, what was the artist in you saying, oh, actually, I wouldn't have done it like that, or was it just general appreciation of his work?
No, for the most part, it was general appreciation of his work. He came up with a really cool and unique style. I think Shardlight is probably one of the most visually striking games that I've ever worked on. He has a real knack for like getting a palette, which I do not. I just do whatever. and he's so seeing the sketches come to life and like just the world coming to life through what he was drawing was great. Like it was cool too, because like, well, the learning experience was interesting for me, because obviously it was my first real team project, so I had to be like, okay, I've drawn this sketch of a room and it makes perfect sense to me, but it doesn't make sense to anyone who's not me. So I have to clearly label what the exits are and what the hotspots are going to be and things like that. So that was interesting.
Yeah, well, as you say, it's a real visually striking game. And Mads Christensen, one of our co-hosts here, he did want to join us tonight, but he ultimately couldn't make it. He played Shardlight recently, and he said it's one of his favorite point and click games of the last few years, and he is a real adventure game aficionado, and that is not light praise.
Well, that's so greatly appreciated. Thank you.
He described it as a complete package of excellent writing, really great music, really great graphics, and just a great story. Did you find that you obviously you weren't doing the graphics, so did you spend more time on the story and the writing, or was it a case of, look, that I've kind of done that? Or did you find, well, I've now got more time, so I will go back over it again and again?
That's a good question. I don't really remember. I think it just kind of boiled down more to, because I'm trying to think, when did we start on that game and when did it come out? It came out in March of 2016.
2016, yeah.
And A Golden Wake came out in October of 2014.
Yeah.
So obviously, we probably would have started working on it at the end of 2014. So
you don't give yourself much time off, do you?
No. Well, I mean, at that point, you know, Golden Wake wasn't doing enough for me to live on. So I was like, well, I'm getting paid to do a game. I better make a game. So yeah, it would have been about a year and a few months. It actually had a pretty short development time. So I guess, so it would have basically just been about half of what it took me to do, say, Lamplight City or even A Golden Wake or what Rosewater seems to be doing. So I guess it was just the same amount of work that I normally do, just minus the art. So that's why it was a shorter development cycle.
Okay. Yeah, it figures that more people working on it equals fuels the development, I suppose, doesn't it? So then we move on to your most recently released game, which is Lamplight City.
Yes.
Which was released in 2018. And you did something different here. You got rid of the staple, one of the staples. You got rid of the inventory. Why did you choose to slightly alter the design?
Well, because I figured if I was making a detective game where the primary focus was investigation and interrogation, having the classic sort of build rudimentary tools out of random objects didn't really have a place there. I just didn't think that worked. And I've cited the Blade Runner adventure game as an inspiration for that, because that game didn't have an inventory either, and yet people still enjoyed it. So I was like, well, I guess you can make an adventure game without inventory, and a lot of people did enjoy it. I mean, you said that you liked it, and that was one of the things that you liked about it, so that was good.
And interestingly,
some of the less positive reviews said that the game didn't have much interactivity, and I think I've realized that it's both because a combination of the fact that it didn't have the inventory combination puzzles, and it had a single click interface. So you weren't like struggling to figure out the interface. And I think that for the more hardcore adventure game fans, that's what interactivity means. And I disagree with that. And I feel like maybe that's a controversial opinion, but that's how I feel.
Well, I think it is. I think if you say to me that a game is interactive because you have to combine a load of random items with a load of random other items, or you have to make your way around an interminable maze to give the game an extra 2 hours, if you say to me that's interactivity, I think that's just a load of old baloney. I completely agree with you.
Well, good.
Lamplight City, I said to you off air, is one of the best adventure games I think I've ever played. And I've said this before in our Discord channel on the Retro Asylum, that if anybody is looking for what I think a modern adventure game should be, it is that. The characters, the graphics, you know, I think are absolutely wonderful. And the story and the world that you've created, the country, the continent of Vespuccia, where did you set out to create a kind of world in which you can set Lamplight City and future games, or did it just develop over time?
It was basically a response to a Golden Wake and Shardlight to an extent, because okay. I found that I think one of the issues that made a Golden Wake suffer was I was a little too faithful to history. Rather than focus on like the characters and the interpersonal relationships more, and make a more compelling character-based drama sort of thing. Yeah. I was very conscious of like, well, I have to depict this moment in history and I have to depict this moment in history. And so I found myself very, in a way, limited by that. And with Shardlight, because it was this completely fictional world, I was like, okay, well, this has some basis in history, because obviously like the aristocracy is based on, you know, the French aristocracy and things like that. So I wanted to make a detective game that was set in Victorian times. But then I was like, if I make a game that's set in Victorian times and I set it in London, it's going to be, one, it's going to be very, we've seen this before. Two, I'm going to have to cast an all British cast. And if I don't do that and I get a bunch of Americans doing British accents, it's going to sound ridiculous, which I already had some of that in Lamplight City, but you know, it's not terrible, I don't think, anyway. You might disagree with me, but so I was like, okay, well, maybe I can do a pastiche sort of alternate history thing. And so that's where I went with that. So I was just like, I mean, when you think Victorian detective fiction, you have a specific idea of what that means and certain images of that. So I'll take that and I'll make it my own thing. So I came up with Vespuccia and I came up with the whole, you know, the city of New Britannia. And yeah, I did a whole like world building document and I came up with everything. I even wrote a national anthem, which never made it into the game,
wow,
but exists. And yeah, I did all of that. And yeah, that's how that came about. And, so yeah, then I had that cool thing to work with and I thought, oh, I'll do something more with that. And that's why I made I'm making Rosewater.
Yeah. And the characters for me is one of the strongest memories and one of the strongest things I took away from the game is just how multi-layered the characters are. I mean, there's barely any character that you meet in the game that is two-dimensional, that is kind of binary, good or bad. The characters, you know, Miles Fordham is a very flawed protagonist, and you've got his partner. Spoiler alert, by the way, I'm about to spoil the very start of Lamplight City. One of the interesting things about Lamplight City is the main character, Miles Fordham, he's a detective, and his partner, Bill Leger, dies in pretty much the kind of opening scene. And then Bill Leger acts as his conscience / kind of vocal manifestation of his thoughts. Was that a deliberate design thing to do? So when you're examining things, it's Bill's voice, not Miles's voice in his head?
Yeah.
Or was that a product of the story?
Yeah, it was totally a product of the story. Cause at first, when I was initially designing it, I knew that Bill was going to die, and I knew that Bill was, the whole thing was that Miles was being haunted by Bill and he needed to, you know, find the guy responsible for his death to allow Bill to move on, and that was going to be the main plot, the main conflict of the story. But I wasn't quite sure how to represent Bill, like, because obviously the game was inspired by Edgar Allan Poe and Charles Dickens, and so I had this idea of like the Poe, the telltale heart thing, and I thought maybe when you like hovered over a hot spot, you would hear a heartbeat or you would hear whispers or something. It was a way more subtle. And so, but then I was like, well, maybe Bill should be the narrator. And I thought about like the old comedy games like Space Quest 6, where Roger Wilco has arguments with Gary Owens and he breaks the fourth wall and they start speaking to each other and people are like, who are you talking to? And he's like, oh, nobody. And I thought that would work interestingly in a game where like the guy is literally hearing a voice in his head. And then I realized that I had already done that in another game that I made. Back in like 2000 something, again, like early days, as part of one of the monthly AGS competitions, I made a game based on Donnie Darko, the movie Donnie Darko.
Okay.
And in that game, Frank the Bunny was the narrator. So anytime you looked at something, he'd be like, hey, Donnie, there's a thing and blah, blah, blah. So I was like, oh, I already did this. Let me just do it again. So yeah, I liked how that worked. Because one of the like ludonarrative, well, I don't know if it counts as ludonarrative dissonance in this case, but like there's always that question of how to handle when you look at things as an adventure game protagonist, because it's like, is there an omniscient narrator that's telling you in second person or third person what's happening? Or is the character thinking all of these things to themselves? Or are they just wandering around looking at things, saying things out loud? And if there are other people around, what do they say? And that sort of thing.
So
that problem kind of solved itself in Lamplight City.
Yeah, and it's I'm sure it has been done in other games, but I've certainly not seen it done like that. And it does give a change to that whole use something with that. No, that's not going to work. And you see the same thing over and over again. So it really is a nice way of him being able to interact with the environment. And the story, I'm not going to spoil any more of the story, but the story I thought was really memorable. Looking back now, do you still see yourself as a, looking back at what you've done, do you still see yourself as a game designer, or do you, and this, I get the impression that you probably wouldn't put too grand a terms on it, speaking to you and hearing what you're like, but do you start to consider yourself an author at this point, or do you kind of veer away from that kind of thing?
I still think of myself as a game designer, because the thing that I like the most is, I mean, obviously I like writing the stories and I like the dialogue and everything. But the interactivity and the conversations and things and just exploring the environments is what I like doing the most. I've tried writing just prose and I'm not good at it.
Really? It surprises me.
Well, it's just more that I'm like, I don't know, too wordy. I mean, Lifelight City was pretty wordy, but it's just like, it's too much. And I'm like, I have to edit it down. And I don't know. I just, my main thing is I like the visual aspect of it too. Just like being able to create a world and like, that first scene in Lamplight City where you're in front of the flower shop, like when I drew that and I had fun doing like all the background noises of the people coughing and retching and all that stuff. Yeah. And then that combined with the music and everything, when I first loaded that up and walked the characters around, I was like, yeah, this is cool. I like this.
Yeah.
So I really enjoy just creating those environments and creating those worlds.
It's very evocative, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even the title screen has that very evocative feeling.
You're
in this almost kind of you're in this kind of quasi kind of historical London, but there's an airship in the sky and it doesn't quite feel right, and it's slightly dissonant, and it really is a evocative. It's good stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, nothing against authors and the power of imagination in reading, but I just feel like I'm better at doing that in the medium of games than I would be in the medium of
medium of book. It's interesting, isn't it, that I even asked the question, and then thinking back at, you know, why I asked that question and why, you know, why would an author be any better than a game designer, you know? And is this, I suppose it does bring into the way narrative within games is seen, and is it still seen as a kind of lesser medium than, I mean, what do you think? I'll ask you the question. I mean, do you see narrative in games as something less than, say, narrative in cinema or even the written word? I mean, where do you see where narrative in gaming is at?
Well, I mean, it's a tricky question because narrative in film and books is a passive experience, whereas in games it's obviously an active experience because you're participating, unless you're just playing like a visual novel or something where you don't make any choices or influence the narrative in any way. But I don't think it's better or worse. I mean, I certainly think that the quality of stories in games has increased significantly in the current, just in the past several years. I mean, you have, you know, AAA games have pretty good stories, and even indie games have good stories, and, you know, indie games are about important things and stuff like that. So it's not just like, I don't know, how do I phrase this? You're not mindlessly going around just like, oh, here's a dumb little story. Like, I don't know, I think narrative in games is at a good point right now. I mean, there's definitely new things that can be explored, and there's like every day there's something new being explored. But I still think it's a young medium, and there's definitely room for growth. So yeah, it's exciting. It's cool to be able to work in that and try doing new things.
It feels like we've come a long way, doesn't it, in the past kind of 10 or so years.
And, sure.
You know, you've said even AAA games now, even the biggest of the AAA games seem to be putting story, you're almost at a level with the bombast, which used to be probably the domain of the indie scene. It is quite interesting.
Yeah.
But anyway, moving on and looking at the horizon. So you tell us what you're working on. We've mentioned Rosewater now a few times during the conversation, but tell us about Rosewater.
So Rosewater is obviously it's a point and click adventure game. It's a Western. It's a Western drama, because I've noticed that the vast majority of point and click Western games are comedies. I looked and there's maybe only like one drama, and I remember hearing about it way back in the day, but don't really know anybody who's played it.
What is it?
There's a series I guess it's the Fenimore Fillmore series. The first two games.
I've heard of it.
Yeah. Mm. There's the Three Skulls of the Toltecs was the first game, which was a comedy.
Right.
And then you had Fenimore Fillmore, the Westerner, which was the sequel, which was also a comedy. And then the third one is, I think it's Fenimore Fillmore's Revenge. And it's like a dark, gritty, it's the same characters, but it's like tonally completely different. And it's like a dark, gritty Western. And So that's really the only
interesting album.
That's like the only Western drama point and click I know of. Mine isn't dark and gritty, but it's not a slapstick comedy. There's no farting horses in it, is what I'm trying to say. It's a Western. It's set in the same universe as Lamplight City, so it's the same alternate 19th century steampunkish world of Vespuccia, except it's in Western Vespuccia. You play as Harley Legere, who is the sister of Bill from Lamplight City. The story is that she gets involved in a hunt for a missing person's treasure. And so you go and gather your posse and go looking for this treasure, and hijinks ensue.
Okay, nice. Well, that is in a nutshell. And it's obviously the same world as Lamplight City.
Yes.
And we've spoken about this kind of world creation thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you've mentioned Harley Legere, the sister of Bill Legere. Will there be other references? I mean, is it set in the same kind of time frame as Lamplight City?
It's set 6 years after. So Lamplight City is set in 1844 and Rosewater is set in 1850. So there'll be some references, yeah. In fact, there's one character I said before, there's a character who I'd really like to put in the game. I found a place for them, so this character's in the game. So there's at least one returning character from Lamplight City. But my intent is to, you know, make it so that you don't have to have played Lamplight City to appreciate the game.
Makes sense.
Like, it certainly helps. And I appreciate if anyone who hasn't played Lamplight City and wants to play Rosewater goes and plays Lamplight City, or, you know, plays Rosewater and likes it and goes and plays Lamplight City. It's not going to be like, I'm not going to know what's going on if I haven't played Lamplight City.
Yeah, sure. And the art style looks, from the trailers, looks somewhat different. And you've said about when you look back at Lamplight City, you kind of think, even though I think it looks incredible. You look like you've changed the art style, though. Is that the case?
Yeah, well, I shouldn't say that I say ugh when I look at Lamplight City. It's more I look at it and I think, how blocky. Because, so Golden Wake and Shardlight were 320 by 200. Resolution. Lamplight City was 640 by 400. Excuse me. Rosewater is 720p, so it's 1280 by 720. So it's twice the resolution of Lamplight City, and it's also widescreen, so that's fun. The art style is essentially the same. It's still painted backgrounds and pixel art characters. It's just higher resolution. So that means that the character sprites have a lot more detail, which is why I look at Lamplight City, I'm like, look, their eyes are just little two little black dots for pixels, or two little black dots for eyes. Whereas these characters actually have like eyes, and I can do facial expressions and body language and things like that. So that's been fun.
It certainly looks pretty.
Oh, thank you.
From the trailers. Yeah, for sure.
Thanks. It's been really cool. The other thing that I've really enjoyed doing is, the like full screen cinematics. So like, there was a little bit of that in Lamplight City with like, there's a bit in the fourth case where you see a first person arm going into a sewer drain.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I can do more of this. So I'm doing I guess it's kind of inspired by Full Throttle, where you had like certain scenes were like enhanced by just like the full screen animations. So that's what I'm doing with this too.
And as you move on and you go from game to game, do you still get that same thrill of a new project, or are you becoming a little bit more kind of battle wary, and is it a little bit more like, here we go again, or is it still, I feel excited, I'm energized?
Yeah, no, I definitely always have that excitement at the beginning of a project. What the moment for me is, like I said, with the scene in front of the flower shop in Lamplight City, like when I have that first screen drawn and I have my character fully animated and I can walk my character around the first screen, I'm like, yeah, this is cool. It's finally real. And then I still have that. And then there's moments where I'm like, ugh. And then there's moments where I'm really excited. But no, I haven't become jaded. I still enjoy doing it. I hope it never gets to the point where I think, oh God, here we go again, because then why bother doing it?
Yeah. You might as well go back to being a legal interpreter.
Exactly.
If you get to that stage. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the size of the production, is it roughly the same as Lamplight City? I mean, I know from the credits, you know, we've said about, you know, there's a cast and director now and it's a bit more professional in terms of that kind of thing.
Right.
Is it the same kind of size of production as Lamplight City?
That's always a really hard question to answer when I'm still working on the game, because I never quite know how long it's going to be. So I've designed the game on paper. But I haven't finished building the game as far as like rooms, or characters or anything like that. Yeah. My hope is that it's going, and my expectation is that it's going to have significantly fewer speaking parts as Lamplight City did, because Lamplight City, obviously, since it was divided into 5 cases and each case had its own cast of characters, and since each case had, like, you know, multiple paths and stuff like that, so there were a lot of characters. Lamplight City, had 70 speaking roles. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's a loss.
It is. It is. And, you know, we had like 20 something actors, so there were some people that had like 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 roles per. But this time around, I'm trying to be a bit more economical with that, because obviously, like, you know, the characters that you're going to be spending the most time with are the 5 companion characters that you are going on this journey with. And you know, there's a few extra characters here and there, but not as many. I don't know if it'll be, I doubt it'll be as many characters. I don't know if it'll be as many lines of dialogue. Lengthwise, I feel like it probably will be about the same length.
Yeah.
I definitely can't imagine it'll be bigger than Lamplight City. Although having said that, Lamplight City had 110 rooms, and as of right now, I'm like midway. I mean, I guess I've gotten most of the rooms in for the first 2 acts of 3 for Rosewater, and I'm up to 75 right now.
Oh wow!
So it's entirely possible that it might get to that size, but it maybe not. I don't know. I don't anticipate the third act being like more than 30 rooms, but I don't know. So we'll see about that.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that actually about the length, because I think sometimes bigger doesn't always equal better, does it?
Yeah.
And it took me about 14 hours to get through Lamplight City. And I enjoyed every minute of it. Yeah. And sometimes I think games I really enjoyed Thimbleweed Park a couple of years ago, but I felt like that game just slightly. I'm sorry, Ron Gilbert. If Ron Gilbert listens to Retro Asylum, I apologize profusely. Mm. But I felt like that game just slightly outstayed its welcome a little towards the end. So I'm glad you said about not just going for bigger for the sake of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about pacing too, because I mean, with Lamplight City, like you said, like I feel like the average playtime is anywhere between like 10 and 12 hours maybe. But
I'm just a bit slow.
No, you're thorough. You're thorough.
Yeah, that's the
thing. But yeah, like also the way that Lamplight City is paced, since it's divided into cases, there are certain stopping points where, like, you know, I've played enough for today. I finished the first 2 cases. I'll put it down and come back to it. That works a little bit better in that case, I think. Obviously, like, you know, Rosewater's divided up differently. So I'm not trying to make it outstay its welcome. But at the same time, like, I want to make sure that, you know, it's about the characters, and I want to make sure that you have enough of a relationship and spend enough time with them to actually care about them, and so that my issue is rushed endings, and I don't want the ending to be rushed. So that's why I'm kind of, you know, figuring that out, and trying to strike that balance between good resolution and padding, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I understand. So, without wanting to put pressure on you, where it's cited as a 2021 release. 2021 is a long time.
Yeah.
Can we can we look forward to it at a certain time in 2021, or is it too early to say?
I mean, in my milestone document and in my self-imposed guide, I had initially said I wanted to have it out by April or May of 2021.
Okay.
But in that same guide, I wanted to have it written by June, and I haven't even started writing it yet. So by writing, I mean like the dialogue and everything. So I don't know. I don't want to push myself too crazily because, I mean, the thing is, like, I'm approaching it a little differently this time. Whereas with Lamplight City, I pretty much designed it. I designed a lot of it, but I started building it and working on it with, I think, maybe the first three cases designed. And I went and did the last two when the game was already in production. And I wrote all of it as I went and then had it and then edited it later. Whereas with Rosewater, I designed it all first. I've been building it so that it's fully playable and all the mechanics are in and everything. But I'm not writing any of the dialogue. I mean, I've started writing some of the dialogue, but I'm not putting any dialogue into the game until it's all written and edited and the script is set in stone, so to speak.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But then there's also all the art and animation to do, even though I've already done all the art and animation for the first act. So at least the game is a third done in that respect. but I mean, that stuff takes time too. So,
for sure.
You know, I don't want to freak out about that and be like, oh my God, it's January and I still have, you know, this many backgrounds to do. So I still think it'll be 2021. I'm confident that we'll still get it out in 2021. I don't want to specifically commit to say like, April or May for sure.
No, I'm not gonna push you any harder. we spoke in the virtual green room before we started recording, and I've heard you talk before about the kind of self-imposed crunch that you put yourself under with Lamplight City, and I suspect is that something that obviously you want to avoid with Rosewater, presumably.
Yeah, I mean the issue with that was what I said before, that I wanted to get the game out as quickly as possible because I didn't have any income and I wanted to get it out. And the thing too with Lamplight City was that it had those close-up portraits and I wanted those to be lip-synced. And the program that I was using, which I had used in the Ben Jordan games and had been great with the Ben Jordan games, but unfortunately the Ben Jordan games had significantly less dialogue than Lamplight City did. Lamplight City had about 8,000 lines of dialogue, and half of those had to be lip-synced, so it was about 4,000 something.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was averaging, even on a good day, just the process of the, because the program, it's this program called Pamela Lip Sync, because I had tried some other ones that did like automated lip syncing, but it just didn't look right.
Yeah.
And it, I felt like, you know, it's a close-up portrait, so the mouth has to look right. And this program had given me the best results, but the way it works is you have to import the wave file of the speech, of the line. You have to type out the text of the line, which it then processes the phonemes, which you then you've already assigned to a particular frame of animation. So you then have to drag them all along the waveform so that they line up correctly. And on a good day, I was getting through maybe 20 lines an hour. So So it was taking a really, really long time. I was like, oh, I'll be able to lip sync. I'll get all this lip syncing done in a month. It took 3.5 months.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, that's, I wanted to have Lamplight City out in again, like April or May of 2018. Mm-hmm. And it didn't come out until September because I had to do all the lip syncing, and that was working, you know, 10 hour days to get all of this stuff done.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, I'm avoiding that again. I mean, I intend to have lip syncing in Rosewater, but there are no close-up portraits. So I'm using Rhubarb, which is the program that they use for Thimbleweed Park.
Okay.
And I've tested it already, and it gets good results. And the beautiful thing about it is that it's completely automated. It reads the file, it does the text, and it does a pretty good job of lip syncing. And all I had to do was write a batch file to process all the lines. So that will take a lot less time. Yeah.
Good. Let's avoid those crunches.
The other advantage is that, you know, Lamplight City is still selling, so I still have an income, so I don't feel the pressure to get Rosewater out as quickly.
Yeah, good. And I'm sure people would prefer it done when it's done rather than rushed out. What can we do, Francisco, to track it, to support, to follow its development? Is there any way in which we can do that?
There are many. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Grunislav Games. I generally post quite a few things about my games in development, and currently that is Rosewater. You can follow me on Twitch. I am just Grunislav on Twitch, and I do fairly regular development streams where I basically will just do like backgrounds or animations or sometimes coding, sometimes voice editing when it gets to that point. So if you want a little behind the scenes look and just want to come hang out, that's always a fun time to chat with the audience.
Cool.
You can join my Discord server. There's a Grunislav Games Discord where you can just come hang out and talk about the games, and I have a Rosewater exclusives channel where I show off things that I don't tweet or show off to anybody. And I have a newsletter, but I have not updated the newsletter since last year, so I should probably do that before I start talking about it. But those are the primary ways you can follow me. And of course, my website, Grunislav Games.
Where's the link to the Discord channel? Is that on the website? Because I've not spotted that.
I should probably put it on my website, shouldn't I? I've tweeted about
I've not seen it.
Yeah, I've tweeted about it a few times. I'll tweet about it and I'll put it on my website. There's a link on my Twitch page as well.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Can track it down somewhere.
I have to cross-pollinate all of the social media platforms.
It's essential.
Yeah. In fact, as soon as we're done here, I'll tweet about my Discord server once again.
Fabulous. And then I can join it.
Yes.
Wonderful. I want to wrap up.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a real pleasure getting to know a little bit more about you and the process of creating the wonderful games that you've given us over the years. And on behalf of all the adventure gamers out there, I just want to say a big thank you for what you've created.
Well, yeah, likewise, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you, and I appreciate you and everyone else who's played and enjoyed the games. That really means a lot.
I'm not going to let you off without asking a couple more questions.
Oh boy.
So, I don't like doing this because I know your focus is on Rosewater, and it looks fantastic, and I for one can't wait to play it next year. Beyond Rosewater. Can we look forward to a Lamplight City sequel at some stage or something else in a different part of Vespuccia? Is there anything bubbling away in those lamp bulb parts of your brain?
I will say that
you can reveal exclusively for us?
Generally speaking, I always like to have at least one project in my mental pipeline as I'm working on one, which is why you'll notice little hints about Rosewater in Lamplight City. I do have something in mind for post Rosewater, but I'm going to keep my cards close to my chest currently.
No.
You'll just have to play Rosewater to find out. Maybe I'll drop some hints in there.
I will say this.
I already have, and this is me again being presumptuous because it's assuming that I'll have like a huge following that will. You were mentioning the God of War documentary before, right?
Yeah.
So there's the bit in that documentary that I thought was fantastic, where they're showing like the first reveal at the Sony thing, and there's like the big reveal with the kid, and then Kratos comes out, and everyone loses their shit. Oh, can I swear on this podcast?
You just did.
Well, whatever. Bleep it. Everyone loses their minds. And like, I have I have an idea for a reveal in a trailer for my next project that I think would be like, it's in no way, shape, or form would get that same reaction from a room full of people unless they were all like hardcore fans of.
Yeah.
Ooh, I almost said something there. unless they were hardcore fans. But yeah, I do have another game in mind. And I have a reveal planned for it. We'll see how it goes. So that's all I'll say.
I'm gonna quit while I'm ahead. I feel like I've done all right there. So I'll settle for that. And I tell you, I can
tell you when we're off the air if you want.
I'll leave that entirely up to you. Okay. But whatever it is, I think you've teased enough.
Okay.
to get people interested and get a room full of the right people.
Yeah.
And I suspect you would get a Craigslist-like reaction to whatever it may be. final couple of questions just to wrap up. So give us three non-Grundislav modern adventure games that you would recommend people play to get a taste of where the genre is at.
Ooh.
If you don't mind doing that at the exclusion of the ones that you're not going to mention.
Yeah. Paradigm is one that I really enjoyed. Paradigm is a comedy adventure made by a guy named Jacob Janerka. It's one of those things where it's like, don't judge a book by its cover, because at first glance, it looks like it's going to be this weird, surreal, like meme focused humor. And it's really not. It's genuinely funny. It's just, it defies description because it's just so bizarre. You play as this mutant guy named Paradigm who just wants to launch his music career. But is antagonized by a toupee wearing sloth who vomits candy bars. So that's one that you should play. Guard Duty by Sick Chicken Studios is another one. I beta tested it on PC, but I actually just picked it up and played through it on PS4. That's a good one too. It's a nice little. It's a charming little adventure. Kind of reminiscent of Discworld and Blazing Dragons, but very much its own thing. And it does this really cool, like it has a lot of really cool concepts. I don't want to spoil too much of the story, but it goes in a couple of directions you wouldn't expect, which is pretty cool.
Okay. Interesting.
And number three, I have to think of, I don't really play that many adventure games. I'm gonna tell you my dirty little secret there.
Two's fine if that's all you've got.
I mean, I started playing Disco Elysium, but that's not really an adventure game, I guess.
Yeah,
it has adventure.
It's borderline, isn't it?
Yeah, it is pretty borderline. But I've enjoyed what I've played of that so far, and I keep meaning to play Heaven's Vault, but I haven't gotten around to that one
studio.
Either.
Yeah. They're based not too far away from me, actually.
Ah, right.
Studio,
yeah.
So, it does look like a nice one. And then final question. Three classic adventure games that you think that ought to be really played by everybody.
Conquest of the Longbow.
That's the one you don't hear very often.
Yep. The Curse of Monkey Island, which I will maintain is the best Monkey Island game. Fight me if you disagree.
Many probably will.
They probably will. That's fine. It's okay
it's
to be wrong.
Game. It's a beautiful game.
I'm just
game.
Stoking the fire here. And, that's tough because there's so many, and yet I have to think really hard about the third one. Because I would say Gabriel Knight, because I love Gabriel Knight 1, but it doesn't. I don't know that it holds up great in certain regards. Let's go with Day of the Tentacle because, of course.
Yeah, you can't really go wrong.
But then I feel like everyone has played Day of the Tentacle, so.
And if they haven't,
they really should.
After they play Lamplight City, they should play Day of the Tentacle.
Yes, a complete tonal shift.
Francisco, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you again.
I'd love to have you back maybe once Rosewater's with us to talk about kind of how that went.
Sure.
In the months that are going to ensue. But I hope everyone does go out and check out your stuff. If anyone has a remote interest in adventure games, as I said, There is so much there and so many hours of gameplay to enjoy. And keep track of Rose Water as well. We'll continue to keep people updated on future episodes of Retro Asylum on release dates as and when it comes available. So, yeah, we're done. I shall bid you adieu. Thank you, Francisco.
Thank you, Chris.
So I'm back, and I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly enjoyed talking to Francisco. Do check out his website. I don't have the URL in front of me, but if you Google Grundislav Games, you're not going to get anywhere other than Grundislav Games' website. And all of his Ben Jorgen games are available there. Lamplight City, Shardlight, and A Golden Wake are available from GOG and other online retail platforms, and generally are pretty cheap. And they are great, great value for money. Lots and lots of games. I said it on the interview. I've said it before. Lamplight City is one of my favourite adventure games, probably ever, but certainly in modern times. It is a wonderful, wonderful story and a slightly different way in which you get around the game. So do check it out. And aside from that, I haven't really got anything else to say. We are in the middle of an Ikari Warriors month in the game club. And just this morning, I managed to loop that at one credit clear. I can count on the fingers of one hand very comfortably the amount of games I can one credit clear. I can now put the Amstrad CPC port of Ikari Warriors to, I think, probably only Manic Miner. Oh, maybe Final Fight on the GBA. So maybe three. Anyway, I was pretty pleased with that. But yeah, Ikari Warriors is going a lot better than I certainly expected it would. I did worry about whether people would engage with it and whether we could play it for a month, but we are halfway through the month already and it seems to be going pretty well. So it just shows that even games that you don't think will hold people's attention for too long can hold people's attention for longer than you think. What else have we seen? Oh yeah, the PS5 reveal. That was quite cool. So we now know what the PS5 is going to look like. I think there's a mixture of opinions. I quite like it. And I think I'll talk to Mads about this a bit more, so I'm not going to say too much when we record the Ikari Warriors episode, but I quite like it and was moderately excited by the way the games look, the way that the load-in times were apparent in the Ratchet & Clank trailer that they showed, and the way in which he could warp in and out of worlds without really a drop in any kind of frame rate was pretty spectacular. That was the game that really caught my eye. I'm a big fan of the series as well. Such an underrated series, I think. But yeah, no doubt Mads and I will unpack that a little bit more in the Ikari Warriors episode, but we will get back to retro, I'm sure. Before I go, I just wanted to thank our wonderful, wonderful patrons. Here they are. Aaron Morpin, Aidan Marriott, Alistair Barr, Andrew Gilmore, Andy Marsh, Blake Brett, Kane & Rince Podcast, Chris Rowe, Clint Humphrey, Darren Coles, Edwards Fitzpatrick, Gary Heather, Gaz H, James Bentley, Jim Orbis IT, John Shepherd, John Veal, Lampton Worm, Lawrence De Bruyne, Lauren Giroux, Manu Cespiona, there you go Mads, tried, Mal Woods, Mark Bilund, Martin Stevenson, Matt Sullivan, Matthew W, Nick Lees, Patrick Fust, Paul Ashton, Paul Davies, a.k.a. Hermsky, new patron. Thank you, mate. Thank you for your support. Reese Wynn, Richard May, Richard Rogers, Rick Jackson, Rose Tinted Spectrum, who I think is not a new patron, but a recent patron. I think his name was something Douglas, possibly David Douglas on the last list. Very, very good member of the Retro Asylum community, and do check out his YouTube channel as well. Salvio Calabrese, Stephen Bell, Stephen Stuttard, Straight to Video, otherwise known as Heavy Metal Don, from our Discord group. He enlightened us on that this week. Thank you, mate. Thomas Goffam, Tony Parkinson, Vido Belochkin, and Vido did tell me
in the week or a couple of weeks ago that I did actually manage to say that correctly last time, so that's good. And finally, and certainly not least, Zach Glanz. So thank you very much to all of our amazing patrons. We truly do appreciate every penny that you give to keep our lights on. Right, so I'm going to leave you to go forth and go about your business, listen to other podcasts, play some games, go to work, whatever you are going to do next. I just want to do, oh yeah, one shout out actually before I do go. I'd like to say a big thank you to our Discord member and listener, Dibblestar, that's his handle. I'm sorry, mate, I don't know what your name is, but Dibblestar, who very, very kindly sent me three old issues of Retro Gamer. Really, really appreciate that for nothing. He posted them, and the coolest thing was he addressed them to my address, to the name Retro Clarence, which caused some hilarity with the postman and my wife who opened the door. But that was, yeah, really cool, really good condition, and I'd happily accept any issues of Retro Gamer that people have, preferably ones I haven't got. I think I'm down, need about 30 to complete the collection. And the other thing I've started buying is old Edge magazines. The older, the better. So if anybody has a collection or a bundle of old Edge magazines that they'd like to get rid of, send me a message on Twitter or on Discord and we can agree a price and I'll take them off your hands. I've got about 20, 25 up to now, so I've got a fair few to go. And I'm not so keen on having a complete set, but I do really enjoy that magazine. So yeah, if you do have any, you want to get rid of them, do hit me up and let me know. Just the usual plugs, Facebook, we are the Retro Asylum. You can come along and have a look at our Facebook page and see what's going on there. We're Twitter, we are at the Retro Asylum, where you will hear first about new podcast releases and other gamey related stuff. Instagram, The Retro Asylum. Our website address is www.retroasylum.com, and on there you will see the link to our Discord group. Do come along and join us. It is still my favourite place to be on the internet. It's an ever-growing community of like-minded people who like all games, but have a particular penchant for classic gaming and retro gaming. So, yeah, there's always something going on in the various channels that we have, so do come and join us. And with that, I shall bid you goodbye, and I will be back with Mads at the end of the month, talking Ikari Warriors. Until then, farewell guys, bye-bye.
From now on, unlike your parents were, you are the secret force of Retro Asylum.
Playing so fast, they're the only ones who can take you back in time. They play old games, they're more retro than J1 Optimus Prime. At home or the arcade for adventures.